My name is Sarah, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Kareth and Giroux, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Barry will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Barry. I'm an alcoholic. Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. Okay. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. This is going to be bad. AA is not allied with any sect denomination. It's my bifocals. Okay. Politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Mary will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Mary. I'm an alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
William will read the traditions.
Hi, William, alcoholic. Hi, the 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Tradition two, for our group purpose, there is one but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself to in our group conscious. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Tradition three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Tradition four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Tradition five, each group has one ultimate authority, or our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Tradition six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any, or tradition six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any relevant facility or outside enterprise. Less problems of money, property, prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Tradition 7, every AA group ought to never be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Tradition 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Tradition 9, as such, A, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards. Our committees directly responsible by those they serve. Tradition 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn to public controversy. Tradition 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We always maintain personal animated level of press, radio, and film. Tradition 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles for personalities.
Tonight is anniversary night. The format of tonight's meeting will be a main speaker who will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our information break and the anniversary celebrants. Our main speaker tonight is Patrick.
Hey, everybody. My name is Patrick Stewart, and I'm an alcoholic. You are a good-looking group. I've been to meetings all over the world, and I say that only to show off. I also say that because I don't think I've ever been in a meeting like this where you come in and you just see people just paired up, reading the big book and going over the steps. It's exciting stuff, you know. I've been to meetings where, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find any mention of God, the big book, and the steps, you know. And I'm just really glad to be here. Thanks, Jeff. Thank you, Lisa. My friend Maria for coming. Wow, the Atlantic Group. What fresh hell is this? What am I doing here? How'd this happen? I have a home group. It's the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. I've been sober. Thank you. I've been sober since 1995. I bottomed out in New York in 1993. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days and shared 2, 3, 4 times during every meeting. Couldn't shut me up, you know. I'd keep sharing until everybody's eyes rolled over in the back of their heads. And then I'd say, well, my work here's done, and collected a 90-day chip and pulled a Geographic, and the rest is history, and maybe I'll get into that in a second. But I come from a long history of alcoholics. My great-grandparents were alcoholic swingers in Belfast. My grandfather proposed to my grandmother with a handgun. They were dating, and he disappeared to Africa during the war, and she started dating a Canadian airman, and he got wind of this, and he went back to Belfast, and he said, where is he? I've got 3 bullets, 1 for you, 1 for him, and 1 for me. And she said, well, he was shot down over the channel, so I'll marry you. My father was in rock and roll in the 60s. I was raised sort of with everybody was in love beads and caftans and Encino. My dad had a record deal with Capitol Records. My mother was a trophy wife, and she likes her wine, you know. And she keeps gin under the sink in the bathroom. She swears it's for cleaning purposes, you know, because it's so much cheaper than Windex, right? And I swear that woman doesn't sleep, you know, and I can't diagnose her, but, you know, she does like her wine. And then there's, you know, me. My dad was reading a book when I was born called Summerhill, which was a school back in England, and it was also a school in Thousand Oaks, California, and basically the idea was letting the kid raise himself, go to bed whenever he wanted to go to bed, and eat whatever he wanted to eat, do what he wanted to do. And I was raised a little wolf boy in my dad's house, you know. And I'd talked my dad into giving me a pack of cigarettes by the time I was 5 years old. And he said, okay, but you have to smoke the whole pack. So there I am, smoking a pack of Camels, looking in the mirror, going over to my neighbor's house, you know. Can Eric play? And Eric's mom was pretty hip. I remember she just goes, sure. You want an ashtray or, you know. My parents split up because in the 60s there was a lot of drugs, alcohol, a lot of other women and stuff like that, and that marriage didn't work out, and my mom shacked up with a neurologist in Phoenix, Arizona, And I stayed with my dad because he was like Peter Pan, you know. I got to do whatever I wanted to do. And that worked for a while until he decided it was time to go back out on tour with his band. And the road was no place for a kid. So he shoved me back off to Phoenix in 1973. And I'd been living with hair down to here, shirtless with puka shells on the beach in Malibu. And then they shoved me to Phoenix, Arizona in 1973. You know, the other kids in my school, they all had pocket protectors and flat tops. And to add insult to injury, my mom shoved me into the Cub Scouts. So there I am, shaggy wolf boy hair, puka shells, Cub Scout uniform. There's a really pathetic photograph of me in those days, and it really sums up the way I felt about myself, you know. I just looked like a freak, and I felt like a freak, and I was treated like a freak. And I just, that was just the earliest memories I had, was just feeling like I just didn't get it. I didn't fit in. And I always thought I was always just a victim. I always thought that other people, I couldn't figure out why, no matter where I went, I was always treated the same way, you know, until, you know, about 11 years old, I talked my dad into bringing me back to L.A., and I moved in with him, and I started to find guys in junior high school and stuff that used to like to play around with all sorts of stuff. I remember I met this kid named Harlan, and his brother had a bong and a trampoline. And life got kind of interesting that year, you know? And then my dad didn't show up to my graduation from, like, you know, junior high school into, like, high school or something, so I decided to punish him by drinking at him. And I remember he had the box of Inglenook Chablis with a foil pack and a couple of goblets with the iron on there from Pier 1. And I took a thing and I sucked it down. I sat on the futon and nothing happened. So I, you know, took another goblet. I sucked it down. I sat on the futon and I waited for something to happen. So I said, you know, I got to get drunk. What's going on? I stood up and boom, I just felt that the lightning in my veins. You know, I felt like I had no idea how, that was the first time I realized how broken I had been because I felt fixed instantly. And I don't know if I crossed a line, but I do know that I knew immediately that I had to do this again, that this is the place that I wanted to be. You know, and I'm going to jump cut now because I've got a short period of time, but it worked, you know, it worked great. And by the time I was in high school, I was a freshman, and I was dating a senior. And the way that worked was I told her, I said, my mom wants to know if you'll babysit. And she says, for who? I said, for me. And we started to hang out, you know, alcohol was working for me, you know, it was liquid courage. Well, jump cut now, I'm now living, you know, in the early 90s, I was living in New York. I'd gotten a job that I'd always, you know, kind of a dream job. I was working for ABC Cap Cities in a matinee, TV matinee, you know, and I was a hot shot. And living like an animal, you know. I had this studio apartment on 95th Street in Riverside that you just wouldn't board a dog there. And I remember I was just drinking, and I was just a wreck. You know, I never did laundry. My sink looked like a biological experiment, you know, and the dishes were fusing together. I started to put them in the bathtub because I had no... And so I'm showering with my dishes, you know, like normal people, right? And I remember in a drunk, I had this idea that I'm on television. I deserve a much better apartment than this. And so I went to the hardware store, and I bought a crowbar, and I tore up the tile to the subfloor, lost interest in the project, you know, passed out. There's a pile of cement for about a year. Now, everybody here knows, in L.A. they may not know, but here, if you tear your floor up to the subfloor, you're living with cockroaches. And I sure was. It was an infestation, you know. You'd go in, you'd flick that light on, and this black floor would turn white instantly. What happened? And, you know, a normal human being making the kind of money I was in those days, I might have called an exterminator or told the landlord or finished the job. But I decided to throw them in the microwave one at a time to serve as a warning to the other cockroaches, you know. Like normal people do, right? And I just was I was getting progressively more and more insane. And you know, you think you're the... You know, my mom used to come to town to visit, and I just wouldn't answer the door. I mean, that's just insanity. She'd fly out from San Diego, and I wouldn't answer the door. And you think you're the only one who knows that you're nuts, but my job found out I was nuts somehow. They let me go. And I remember thinking, well, you know, to heck with them. You know, I'm just going to drink now. So my mornings started, I would wake up and smoke a joint, and then I'd drink rum because I thought I was a pirate, I think is what I was doing there. 4 grams of mushrooms, and then I'd get out of bed, you know? Sit in my papasan chair, wait for night to come, some point I would go unconscious, and then I'd wake up and I'd start the pattern over again, and that went on for a good year and a half, you know. Just a hellacious period in my life, you know. I would never wish that on anybody. And if you're new, I think you might know what I'm talking about, that level of emptiness that I was experiencing. And there was a moment in my life when a friend came to visit me, looked at me with a pity that only a friend can look at you with. And when she left and that cab drove away, I just remember thinking, I can't possibly go back in this apartment. I felt like I was going to die in there, but I couldn't. There was nowhere to go. And I was walking down Riverside Park, and I just had nowhere to go. And I stumbled upon my old job, and a friend of mine that I used to work with saw me, and I didn't realize she was in Al-Anon. And I'll always be grateful for this, because she let me in her work, and she didn't judge me, she didn't lecture me. She just let me know that there was a warm body there, just a human being there that was okay with my being there. You know what? Sometimes we don't have to really hard nose a 12-step on somebody. Sometimes just giving them that warmth of that a handshake or something. Somebody in the room, that was enough for me, you know? And when she told me, I think you need to check out Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember thinking, well, you're clearly misguided in this area, because it's when I stop drinking that the problem starts, you know? That's when the nuttiness cannot be contained. But it was the only kindness that anyone had really extended to me. So I went to Fireside. And that is where it all started for me. Thank you. And I was just so grateful for that place. You know, that they didn't judge me, and they could have. God knows, because I was sharing all the time. You couldn't shut me up. You know, my hand was going up all the time. I would have shared all the time. And I got a chip based on basically fellowship, you know. I didn't read the big book. Pronounced myself cured, moved to Los Angeles. Played Tetris for a year and a half on my little Mac Plus computer. Burned through my money, and God in his infinite wisdom sent me a girl just before my money ran out. She was a Ferrari, man. She was just, boy, she was rich, exciting, knew the cast of a hit television show, and used to introduce me to these amazing people, had this great house. And, you know, how I tricked her into believing that I had anything to offer is just testimony to the human spirit. You know, God bless her. And we started a date, you know, and it was great for like 6 weeks. And the problem was, I'm a freak. I know I'm a freak. If you love me, this coil is starting to tighten up. I got a problem. I got a big problem, and it needs to be solved. I start saying weird stuff all of a sudden. Where's this coming from? She says to me, she goes, we need to go back to Georgia. My grandmother's dying. And I said, well, that's what happens to old people. Now I have the self-awareness to know that that's a weird thing to say to somebody. At the time, she looked at me in a way that I don't like being looked at like this. She's got a problem. It must be that her skin is too thin. I'm going to go out and get a breather. And before you know it, we were at a wedding one time in Newport Beach. The champagne started to go around, and I just sucked it down. I didn't even think about it. Didn't even, just no hesitation. And she says, I thought you didn't drink. And I said, I don't know if anybody here has used this. I can drink a little bit. And I said, well, if I can drink a little bit, and I made friends with the bartender, and he gave me this little bottle of Jack Daniels, and I drank the whole thing. Now, I haven't had any alcohol in my system for about a year and a half. And I was really ill. I wasn't just drunk. I was ill. I was throwing up. I was just ill for about a week. And she looked at me like there was something wrong. Now, I don't like being looked at like there's something wrong, not by the person that loves me, you know, that should be filling the void. So, you know. So, I start drinking out of the back of my 1984, you know, Civic hatchback, you know. The problem with drinking out of the back of your car secretly is that there's always a reason to leave, isn't there? It's like, I got to go to the hardware store, and then you come back like the next day, you know. And then she gives you that look, and I don't like that look, so now I got to go again. And just fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting until one day she just came back and from a trip, and she says, I don't want to be with you anymore. I was all like, what? And she said, I think you have a problem with alcohol, and you're abusive, and I don't want to be with you anymore. And I remember thinking, you know what? Nobody breaks up with a lead character in the story. That's just stupid. I'm Luke Skywalker. You don't dump Luke Skywalker. He's the lead guy in the story, you know, but I couldn't talk her out of it. I remember she's shoving me out the door. I said to her, just pathetic. I'm like, but I love you. I love you. And she says, really? Brilliant. I love her for this. What's my middle name? Touche, man, touche. I had no idea what her middle name was. And I remember I drove back to the west side where I was been sharing this little crack den with this roommate that I hadn't really seen in months because I'd been freeloading off her for so long. And I said a little prayer that night. First time I ever said it, God, please help me. And we've all said it, haven't we? And it I promise you, newcomer, as corny as it may sound, that was the beginning for me. All sorts of just really amazing stuff has happened since I said that prayer. And I called a guy in New York. I told him the situation. He goes, I've been waiting for this call. I said, well, if you've been waiting, why didn't you tell me? He says, you would have never believed me, but I'm so glad. I'll make a call. You'll be in a meeting no time. And I went into that meeting over there in 26th and Broadway in Santa Monica, California. My hair was smoldering. You know, I had the fire blanket around me. I'm sobbing, about 50 pounds lighter than I am now. I'm chugging cigarettes, weeping, 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 you know. This guy walks over to me and says, you're new, aren't you? And I remember thinking, wow, yeah, I am new, you know. How do you guys do that? And he says, you have a sponsor. I said, no. He says, you do now. Call me every day. And he put his card in my hand, and I went home, and I used a Sharpie, and I wrote that number on my desk because I was so terrified I was going to lose it. I was so scared. I was so broken. I was so sad. And you know, I think in those days, who knows? Did I really want to get sober? Probably not. I just wanted to get back in the house. I don't think it really matters why you come. It matters why you stay. You know, I did catch alcoholism, thank goodness. You know, I came to enough meetings. That guy had me going to meetings every day, and he had me getting commitments at every meeting. And I'd be like, whoa, 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 whoa. How long are these commitments? You know? And he goes, they're a year. And I'm like, you know, because I... And he says, well, I guess you have to stay sober a year then, don't you? And I didn't really have an answer for that, you know? So I started to go to meetings all the time. I didn't have any money. Now, I'm a big shot. He says to me, well, what do you do? I said, I do soap operas. He says, well, they don't seem to be beating a path to your door. What else are you capable of? I'm like, I've never done anything else except wait tables, which was a huge mistake. I should never have said that to him. Because he has me applying at all these restaurants, right? I'm a big shot. And he's got me applying to Kate Manolini's and the Stinky Rose, and they all passed. And finally, I meet a girl, at the meeting, and she goes, why don't you go over to Earth, Wind, and Flower, where I work? So I go down there, and I apply, and I get the job, you know? First day I am there, I'm like learning the menu and wiping the menus, and somebody goes, hey man, you're Will on All My Children. And I was like, yeah, you want iced tea or, You know, day two, I'm like waiting on somebody, and she goes, can I get a picture with you? And I'm like, can I take my apron off, please? You know, and it was just, you know, the beginning of a deflation, you know. I'm all I think about. I'm all I think about. And I needed to be brought down into something that was moldable, you know. I had to be humbled, you know. That's not something that you sign up for, you know. It's something that life tends to do to you. And I remember God was not done with me yet, because after about a month at this restaurant, I look into my section and I realize that her, the one whose name I didn't remember, agent is sitting in my section. And I have to wait on him. And he looks up at me and he goes, Patrick? And I was just like, ugh. And he leaves me the sympathy tip, $20 on like a $30 check. And I was just, ugh. I'm sucking cigarettes, calling my sponsor. He's cracking up. He has me making amends, you know. I had a hobby when I was out there called insurance fraud, you know. You know, I'm really lucky that I had the kind of sponsor that was okay with me not really forcing the books open. He said, listen, what you're going to do is you're going to start writing checks, and it's going to hurt, you know. And he had me writing checks to Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, mailing them, and saying a prayer while I was standing at the post office. And you know what? The stuff, these chains that I'd been carrying around me really did lift, you know? I started to become honest about this stuff. And we did an inventory, you know? And boy, that stuff that I was just going to carry to the grave with me, you know, just lifted. And I looked across the room at him. For the first time in my life, there was a human being. Wow, where'd that come from? A human being that knew everything, all the stuff, the dark, sick stuff. And he didn't judge me. And he would smile at me across that meeting. And I loved him, you know, I loved him. And I remember I went back to Minneapolis to visit my brother. He was living in Minneapolis at the time. And I had started diluting my program. I don't know if anybody here, any newcomers, hedging their bets. Maybe you want to do transcendental meditation. Maybe you want to do Course in Miracles. Maybe you're reading, like, Care of the Soul. Maybe you're reading a bunch of stuff aside from AA, just in case this AA thing doesn't work out for you. That was me, right? I was doing that. And I was visiting my brother, and my brother just goes, hey, you want to walk the dog? I'm like, no, I am fixing my life. And, you know, he leaves, you know, and I'm like, I've got all these books on his coffee table, and I'm thinking, I just remember it just came crashing down. I remember, you idiot, why don't you just rake his lawn, you know? Why don't you just rake his lawn? And I went outside, and I started to rake the guy's lawn, and I'll tell you what, after about a minute, 2 minutes, that hole that had been this big just started to be this big, you know? I just realized it was a moment that I really, really got that when I'm of service to somebody else is when I finally start to feel better about myself. Thank you. And I'd been trying my whole life to be a rock star. I've been trying to fill it with women and synthesizers and laser splitters, and I just cratered, you know? And I remember when my sponsor said, it's time for you to walk through this door that says, here's a door to an ordinary life. And I remember, I didn't hear ordinary, I heard boring, you know? And I remember just thinking, I got nothing else to go. I will, you know. And here I stand before you. I got a lot going on. You know, I got a lot going on. My first sponsor, it turned out he wasn't as sober as long as he said he was. He'd been lying. He'd gotten loaded just before meeting me. I didn't know that until he was locked up, 1 year sober. You know, and a lot of people said, boy, are you mad? Are you mad? And for a moment, I didn't know how I felt. But I tell you what, the message was the message. I stand here 15 years later based on the foundation that guy laid for me. So I'm still grateful to that guy. And my next sponsor was also named Steve. I like to have my sponsors all named Steve. It makes it easier for me. Notice that I wasn't talking to my dad. And that was an issue that was very sensitive for me, and I wasn't going to bring it up. I hadn't seen my dad in 10 years. And my father called me one day, and he says, he lives up in Sun Valley, Idaho, and he says, your brothers and sisters are growing old. They don't know you. Any chance you can come up and visit? And I thought, what attitude was... This is a crummy attitude. No, I can't, Dad. Sorry, I'm not going to see you. He says, well, can you come up for Christmas? I said, no. And I was furious, and I called my sponsor. He says, looks like somebody's going to Sun Valley, Idaho, you know? And bring presents for your brothers and sisters and no gift certificates because those don't count. And, you know, I went to Sun Valley, Idaho, and I was calling my sponsor from the airport. And I said, I can't do this. He says, you can be a good son for a couple of days. And I got off the plane, and this monster... In my brain, you know, wasn't a monster. It was this little English guy who was weeping. He was so happy to see me. And he started to talk so quickly because he was so afraid that I was just going to jump back on that plane. And we went for a hike, and we had a dinner that his wife cooked for us that was so great. And afterwards, I did what I had rehearsed with my sponsor, and I went out to the living room, and I said, I have something to tell you. You know, I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous now. And I am so sorry, and I regret so deeply denying us a relationship based on whatever I thought was going on. And if you will allow me to, I would love to be back in your life. And he wept, and I wept, and we hugged each other, and I went back to LA, and I had my dad back. Now, if that was the only thing that I got out of coming to AA, and God, and the big book, and the steps, I would still be overpaid. But you know what? That gave me an opportunity to be a dad. And I'm a dad now. I have 2 children. I have an 8-year-old, and I have a 4-year-old, and I have a beautiful wife. We've been together 10 years. And it just, the riches, you know. My son has big feelings. My 8-year-old has big feelings. Very independent to anybody else in the house except me. I get what he's going through. And I have the opportunity to sit with my 8-year-old when he's having some big feeling at soccer or something. And I sit with him and I say, honey, you know that daddy has big feelings too. And we can have big feelings together. And that is God. You know, God, the big book, the steps, rooms like these, people like you. When I was living in New York, I was a jerk. I didn't mean to be. I had the best intentions in the world. I'm the king of actions betraying my intentions. You know, but it didn't stop me from going to the celebrity dog walk and just talking crap to somebody who was just trying to say something nice to me. You know, hey, I'm a big fan. Hey, I've seen your show. Really? Do I know you? You know, I didn't know where that came from. I was just a jerk. And I worked in New York last year, and I got a chance to go back to L.A. And, thank you. My 4-year-old had said, bring me a Yoda. Well, you find a Yoda. Yoda was like 1982, man, you know. So I'm looking at F.A.O. Schwartz 2 times. Don't find a Yoda. I go to Toys R Us in Times Square. I don't find a Yoda. I buy like a poster and I buy like some stuff and I'm hoping he's going to be cool with this. And I'm standing at the airport in LAX when I get home. And a guy taps me on the shoulder. And he says, hey, man, I like your work. And I turn to him and I said, thanks. What do you do? He says, I deal antique toys. And I said, that's incredible. I got to tell you, my little son has wanted me to find a Yoda in the worst way, and I wasn't able to deliver. And he reaches in his bag and he says, here, give him this. It's a little Yoda about the size of a grapefruit. I begged my son to let me bring it back to New York with him, but he wouldn't part with it, you know. And I said, thank you very much. You know, I have that. We all are entitled to that, you know. That's God, the big book, the steps, rooms like these, and fellowships, you know, and people like you. So thanks for letting me share tonight.